Hello and welcome to On the Line. I'm Carl Richter. For this episode, Dr. Laura Sykes, Texas A&M University Texarkana History Professor, returns for our local history series. And today we're talking about food, specifically what someone living in Texarkana around 1900 to 1915 or so would have been eating at home every day. It's very interesting, and it's guaranteed to make you hungry. So here's my conversation with Dr. Laura Sykes. Dr. Laura Sykes is back for another local history podcast, and today we are going to talk about everyone's favorite subject, food.
Yeah, food history is so cool because, first of all, everyone eats food, and so we all know what it's like, but also it can connect us to people who came before and the local agriculture and nature. It's got everything in it.
And there's a particular word that we've been using in talking about this that not everyone may be familiar with, and that is foodways.
Yeah.
Can you sort of unpack what that word means and how it's used your circles?
Yeah. For historians, foodways is when we talk about not just food itself, but how we're preparing food, where we're getting food from, what kind of foods we're eating, who's eating what, who's preparing what for whom. It's all of the cultural practices and traditions around eating food, which includes, you know, social, political, every sort of aspect of life that you can imagine, as well as, you know, natural and agricultural.
Wow. So it's a really big, encompassing word.
Yeah, like if we're talking about foodways, we're not just going to talk about the food that we're eating. We're going to talk about the technology that it was prepared on, the ways that it was grown, who might have been growing it, you know, how they're going to be enjoying it, what it means within the family or within the individual's life. So it's a bigger idea than just food itself. But I think we can all understand how important food is and how foodways are a thing that we still all experience. Mm-hmm.
So where should we start locally? What do you think?
Well, I thought that this time we could talk about like what would be happening at home. And then maybe if we want to, we could follow up if people want more information on food with like local restaurants and things like that. But since most people are eating at home in the early 20th century, then I thought we could start at the home itself. We're kind of going to be in the area, the time area that we were talking about last time, which is going to be sort of the early 1900s. So I found a paper from a woman named Judith Hoffman, who is a local Texarkanan, that was written in 1994 about local foodways from 1900 to 1915. And so I thought we would use that as our starting point to discuss what people back in the day were doing with food and how they were getting it and how they were preparing it.
And this is really a remarkable sort of paper, isn't it? You share it with me, and it's just super valuable. I'm so glad it's on the record.
Fabulous. I've been sharing it with everyone I see. I'm like, please read this paper. I actually even reached out to my colleague Tom Waggy to try and find Judy Hoffman. We haven't done it yet, but maybe we will.
If you're out there, give us a call.
Your paper ruled. Okay. So what she does in this paper is take us through the typical day in the life of a Texarkana homemaker. So what I've done is pulled out some of the food-related items and sort of augmented it with my own historical knowledge of how things would have worked. And we can talk about sort of just how people would have been eating at home. So I thought that we could start with talking about the actual homestead, like the place where people are going to get most of their food. Because we have to remember that this is a time when most of the things that people are consuming are things that they're making themselves or growing themselves, especially around here, especially in rural areas. And of course, we are an agricultural area as well. So unlike in big cities and places like that, most people would have had on their own land resources that would have helped kept them fed and fed their families throughout the year. They would have had wells on their property. Almost everyone would have had wells. There's not really a public water system to speak of for most people around here at this time. And so you would have had fresh well water. You might have also had a smokehouse in the backyard. Mm-hmm. Most people did. we don't really think about that as a normal feature of our kitchens or our food lives today. Yeah. In fact, we'd probably be a little surprised to see someone have one on their land, but this was really common back then.
And we're not talking about like a smoker that we would see today to cook the food. This is about preserving
the food. That's right. They would have looked, I mean, it would have looked like a little shed or kind of outhouse type of thing. Like a small wooden structure. And it would have been used to cure meats. And the meats are coming from animals that you're raising and butchering yourself. Mm-hmm. So my dad, for example, remembers being taught how to butcher a pig when he was young. He's from Alabama, but a rural area. And I myself have never witnessed this act. And I think I might be slightly horrified by it because I'm so far removed from it.
Yeah, my Arkansan grandmother used to talk about killing chickens.
Yeah, so they would have had chickens that they're raising. And they would have had a little chicken coop probably. They would have gotten fresh eggs and also chicken meat from that as well as feathers. They would have had pigs that they're raising, and they'd probably slaughter the pig about once a year. And then what they would do is they would butcher and then preserve the meat for that in the smokehouse for use all year long. They would get their ham, bacon, all of their pork, tenderloins, things like that. Everything would come from a pig that you had raised yourself and preserved the meat for yourself. And, you know, it means that you're also having a different relationship with animals in the household. You know, children would have often been pulled into helping out with chores related to animals in particular. So, of course, they had a different relationship with the animals than we do now, where they're generally just our pets and not food. Mm-hmm. At that time, they would have been a mixture of both and would have had a very different sort of reckoning with the way that food and the world mm-hmm. works than mm-hmm. we do today. They would have also had a cow, and the cow would have been used for milking mostly. And the mom or the children would be sort of charged with the milking, and they would go out and, you know, get the milk and then make that into cheese, butter, sweet milk, buttermilk, everything that they needed. Now, we have to remember that pasteurization is not common then. Now, pasteurization, I don't even know if it was invented yet, but I'm not going to Google it.
By 1900, I think, probably.
Louis Pasteur, email us. but the thing about milk and barnyard animals in general is that cows, you know, defecate around mm-hmm. the area in which they live, and you can get things like E. coli into your milk and things like that. So it wouldn't have been the same standards of safety that we enjoy today. But they did have, you know, certain methods to make it as safe as possible. They're also going to have all sorts of things to add to what they're eating around the land. They might have had beehives and been making their own honey. And they would have had a lot of garden foods and vegetables. Okay, hang on. Oh, we're hearing that pasteurization was already invented then. Okay. They were not doing it at home.
Right.
Thank you. They would have had gardens at each house. And in the gardens, they would have been growing foods that are typical around here. Squash, soybean, fruits and vegetables. Like we had a lot of fruit trees here. And we're also going to have blueberry bushes, all kinds of berry bushes, nut bushes, basically fruit and nut trees that are native to the area. And then they would have used these to not only eat throughout the year, but they would have used it for canning. Mm-hmm. So they would have canned the food that they grew in the summertime and in the autumn, and then canned that for use throughout the winter to last to the spring. Mm-hmm. So they're really thinking ahead about how they're going to feed their family throughout the year. Now, they do have stores at this time, and mm-hmm. we'll talk about that. But the majority of what people are going to consume is going to come from the house itself.
What about hunting?
Hunting and fishing are big supplements. Hunting is going to be, you know, sort of done by more of the men of the family. Fishing, however, is going to be done by everybody pretty much all the time, and kids are going to contribute fish a lot mm-hmm. to their mm-hmm. families. And they would have also smoked and preserved the meat from hunting and fishing to last throughout the winter. Mm-hmm. So It was definitely a supplement, and one that was especially good for poorer people who didn't have access to grocery foods or things like that to supplement their diets. So let's start with like when you woke up in the morning, what are we going to do for food? Okay. So first of all, in our household, we might have a gas stove, but we're probably going to have a wooden stove. Mm-hmm. Most people around here did. Although if you get closer to the city of Texarkana, we're going to have more actual like gas and then later electric appliances. Mm. And in the country areas or the more rural areas, we're going to continue to have these wood stoves. So if you do have a wood stove, you're going to have to build the fire. Now, who do you think has to get up and build the fire?
Mom.
Mom has a very, very long day.
Yeah.
Mom's going to spend up to 16 hours a day doing household chores and things like that during this time. It was very taxing. She would have woken up very early. She would have gotten dressed before breakfast, which this is crazy for me, but she might have put on stockings, maybe even some little heels, a bonnet. I would never wake up early enough to get fixed up before I fix my fire, but there we go. Yep. They'd be like, Mom's never dressed up for our fire. I'd be like, get over it. But this is a time when women are really expected to present themselves in a certain way in the home. So she's going to get up, get dressed, and then she's going to get the wood, matches, maybe use some kerosene. And then this is the interesting part. On the wood stove, she has to basically know how hot it is.
Right.
So today we have temperature gauges on everything. It makes it super easy for anyone to cook. You just put it to 350 and you're ready to go. Back then, there was nothing like that. I mean, there were thermometers, but we have in this paper people saying like even though we had a thermometer, my mom never used it. She just used her hands. Like she would just know how hot it was based on years and years of experience.
And we're talking about like most often like a cast iron pot belly stove.
That's right. Yeah, cast iron. And it would have a couple of extra features in it as well. It would have like a little warming area on the top. We're going to talk about that in a minute when we talk about leftovers. Mm-hmm. And it would have also had probably a water heating tank, a little boiler on it. Mm-hmm. And it would boil 10 plus gallons of I think I actually have the number here, a few gallons of water. And that water would stay hot for the rest of the day, up to 24 hours, according to these sources. 4 to 5 gallons, and it'll stay hot for a day. So anything you need with that hot water, whether it be like coffee or doing the dishes, even cleaning clothes, things like that, you would have had this hot water available that's already been heated by your wooden stove. So the mama would have gotten up and done that and gotten the stove already. And what do you think they're going to be eating for breakfast?
I'm going to guess eggs.
Yes. Fresh eggs from their chickens.
Some home-baked bread, maybe.
They do have access to white bread in particular, and they are making bread. But for breakfast, we're going to have something a little different.
Grits?
Biscuits.
Oh, of course.
Biscuits. We might have grits as well, which is, of course, next to malaised corn out of hominy. But biscuits are a staple here. And we have in this wonderful paper, we have people talking about how even when they would have white bread at home, they preferred their mama's biscuits. You know, their mama was just the best biscuit maker. I'm sure we've all heard things like that before. And my papa, when I was growing up, he always had fresh biscuits made by the time I woke up, which was about 3 or 4 hours after everyone else had already woken up. Okay, so we're going to have biscuits, eggs. We're probably going to have some homemade sausage from the smokehouse from that pig we killed. We're going to have coffee. Everyone loves coffee, and they always have ever since we found it. You might have hot cereal. You'd have some milk, and, of course, the milk would come from your cow. Homemade butter, which you have churned yourself. And jellies and jams that you have canned and preserved yourself.
Yeah.
So almost everything is coming from the homestead when we're talking about this meal. And it would have been a very important meal.
we talked about keeping that water hot. What about keeping things cool? Was this the era of the ice box?
Oh boy, I have a lot to tell you about the ice box.
Okay, am I skipping ahead?
Yeah, just a little bit. Okay. You're right on. I'm just fascinated by the ice box. Yeah. We're going to talk about
okay.
it. So they're going to, in the morning, they're going to have like sit down prayers with their meals as well. This isn't like, you know, everyone nowadays just like grabs a bowl of cereal or a bar and they run out the door. This breakfast is a different thing. It's a family thing. You all sit down, you have your prayers, you talk about what you're going to do for the day. It's a ritualized and very family focused experience. And in fact, all these meals are going to be eaten as a family in general. We're not going to have this sort of atomized, chaotic mealtime that is so common today.
Yeah.
For better or for worse. You know, I can imagine a lot of us would be very bored sitting there during a long family breakfast with right. you know, prayers at the top and everything. But this is the custom. And they're preparing their children for to go to school for the day, and then the husband probably to go to work or whatever it is. Now, they are going to also at this time make their lunch, because we don't have school cafeterias and places to eat for lunch for students or for workers in general. And so they're actually going to bring their lunch with them, and the mom is going to prepare it. Now, a lot of times they would, for the lunches, they would use the bread that the mom has baked. Usually mom's baking bread about like once a week, maybe more if she needs to. They might buy bread. We're going to talk a little bit about grocery stores, but in general, we're making our own stuff now, even though if you wanted to, you could buy it. I mean, it's not like you can't. Mm-hmm. They would probably have a hogshead cheese or some sort of, which sounds nasty. We can talk about a little bit later, some sort of equivalent to luncheon meat. And that would have been a lunch that they can take with them to school, maybe some fruits and things like that. So mom's time already, as we can tell, is spent with a lot of food preparation. And that would have been really her life during this time. In 1900, the average household spent 58 hours a week on household work. Mm. And because of the gender dynamics at the time, almost all of that would have landed on the woman. Mm-hmm. So that's almost a 60-hour work week of doing things around the house. We don't have labor-saving technology like washing machines.
Right.
We don't have all sorts of things that we take for granted now that are run by electricity and things.
Off-the-shelf clothing.
Absolutely. So for the woman, the bulk of the bulk of her time is going to be going to household chores, and the man is generally not going to assist like we expect today. Today, we work around, in a household, we usually do about 14 hours of household work a week, which is not a lot compared to 58. And especially if you consider that today.
Who's we, by the way? I think right. Mine's more like four.
Well, you should know that men still spend 40% less time on household work than women. But of course, this number is equal, has gone of men, the amount men is doing is going up every year. And it really equalizes to the level we're at now by like 1975. That's when we sort of start to see work week for household work drop below 20. So we've kind of been living in this less household work mode for a while now. Now, they expected women to do it, and we have a quotation from the St. James Guild of the St. James Episcopal Church of Texarkana in 1908. And they prefaced their cookbook with these words: "Until the nature of man is completely altered, cooking is the most important thing for a woman."
Oh, wow.
So that's pretty heavy. And I think that that shows how people thought about it. It wasn't just something that women did. It was their duty, right? Mm-hmm. It was an expectation of them.
Yeah.
Now, what's she going to do after she gets her breakfast cooked? Well, she'll probably start on these chores around the farm. Milk products is a big part of it, and we mentioned this earlier. Now, everybody, you know, buys all of their milk products. We don't even think about it. But back then, everything's coming through your cow. And I have a picture of my great-great-grandmother milking her cow out in Bradley, Arkansas. So I know my family had a cow. I have a picture of her milking it, right? So this is real stuff that happened, folks.
And without that milk, you wouldn't be here.
That's right. That's why I'm so strong. So the first thing you think of when you think of milk is what the paper called sweet milk, which is just what we think of as regular milk. Mm-hmm. And of course it's unpasteurized because they're making it at home. They would just strain the milk through a cheesecloth and put it in a jar.
Yeah.
And there we go.
That's the word, cheesecloth.
So you would put the stone jar into tubs of cool well water to cool it down. And then you would put it in an ice box. And here we go. We're into the ice boxes. Now, ice boxes are the precursor to refrigerators, obviously. Almost everyone has an ice box by 1900, even in a place like this. It would have been a technology that was pervasive in almost every American home.
Yeah.
But, of course, the ice box is just a box without the ice, right? So how are we getting ice to here? I mean, it's the end of September, and it was 98 degrees yesterday or day before.
I think I've read a little bit about this. Isn't this the time when refrigerated train cars were invented?
There is refrigerated train cars, but we're not even getting that yet.
Okay.
Sometimes we are. There's a really interesting thing about being in the South, and that is that it's hot. Now, the ice, of course, comes from the North when we're talking about natural ice. There are two kinds of ice at this point. There's natural ice and artificial ice. Artificial ice is invented in the second half of the 1800s, but it's so expensive to produce. Like the machinery hasn't been perfected yet that it's easier for most of this period to actually get ice from places like New England and even from Norway and bring them down here. We don't think about ice as an industry, but it was a huge international industry during this time.
I just thought of something.
What?
Ice House. The Hopkins Ice House.
Yeah, Ice House. You're
they
right.
They must have chipped it in and kept it.
What do you think
somewhere?
They would have kept it in, Carl?
Insulator. Sawdust.
That's right. Yay. You get an A in history for today. So it isn't until World War I that we have more plant ice than natural ice as a country. And the reason that it become that plant ice, which is, of course, this manufactured ice that comes from plants, not plants that grow, but manufactories, isn't going to take over to World War I because it's not really cost efficient compared to the natural ice. You would think that hauling all that ice from Norway would be cost inefficient, but actually there's a huge monopoly, just like there is on almost everything at this time, and they're going to make that ice move. So
I want to read about the Ice King.
Oh, he's a guy.
I'm sure.
He's a guy. I might have even put his name in here. We'll see. So there is a little exception to that, though. In the South, we're going to develop plant ice before they are in the North. And this makes a lot of sense because the North is closer to the place where the ice is created. It grows. I don't know how you talk about where it freezes.
Right.
And so it's just going to be cheaper for a very long time for them to get that natural ice. But here in the South, we're going to have a couple of issues. So first of all, I don't know if you've ever heard of an ice famine.
No.
It's not something that we really have today, but when everyone relied on natural ice for their ice boxes, so there are about, 50 plus years where people all have ice boxes and we're still not making ice, right?
Right.
So there were years when there wasn't enough ice to go around. There would be years where it was unseasonably hot or where when the ice harvest had been low, and there wouldn't be enough ice for everyone in America. And these years were called ice famines.
Because it's like a crop in a way.
Right. I mean, it's necessary for so many things. And because we've already become reliant on it at this time. From 1860 to 1864, there was a national ice famine. And of course, this corresponds with the dates of the Civil War. Yeah. But it's only one of many ice famines that that hit this country. And the problem is not just with me wanting nice ice cold lemonade on a hot afternoon. It's that at this point, we've already begun to use it in important things like hospitals and keeping medical things cool. And in fact, some of the earliest plant ice is going to come from the South. Some of the earliest efficient plant ice, I should say, is going to come from the South during these ice droughts these ice famines, because we're going to need water, frozen water, to keep ice in our hospitals and essential sites like that. Mm-hmm. So We might be getting our ice from a natural source, or we might be getting it from plant ice at this point. Even though the whole country doesn't convert to plant ice until after World War I, we're a little bit faster on that because of the necessity that we have here in the South to find ways to do it.
Yeah.
And of course, we help to innovate as a result of our need for the ice and its lack sometimes. We're not going to have actual freezers like what we think about, like in the house, until much later. So this is just an insulated box where you put the ice in and it keeps the stuff cold. It doesn't create ice, right?
Right.
This ice is really cheap, actually. It's about 6 to 8 cents for a big block of ice. And that's like a dollar in our own time. So it's cheap. I mean, it's honestly cheap. Like buying ice is still cheap.
Yeah.
So everyone would have been able to afford it pretty much. And you would have seen out here in Texarkana in the streets, wagons and buggies carrying ice around, delivering ice almost all the time.
Yeah, I've seen those tools, like big pincers.
Those little grabbers, right?
Yeah.
They still use those. This ice is going to be used to, it's going to be delivered and you'll use it in your house to keep your milk and things cold. So even though we don't have refrigerators like we think of, we can preserve food for quite a while in these ice boxes, unless there's an ice famine on in which you're in trouble, right? So the ice boxes is one element of what we have going on. And we're going to talk about another, which is a warming cabinet, which is going to be our sort of ersatz microwave, which is on top of the stove. And this really comes from what's going to happen at lunch. All right. So at lunch, which we call dinner here, right? And then what's the later meal?
Supper.
Okay. I still get some people commenting on that when I'm like, excuse me, I'm from the country, leave me alone. So dinner.
And 3 o'clock is evening.
That's right. So dinner is lunch, and it's going to be the biggest meal of the day. If people can come, depending on whether they're at school or work, the family will sit down and have it all together. And typically, you know, people would come home for it from work if they live close enough to home. And lunch is going to not only be, the food for lunch is not only going to be your dinner, it's also going to be part of your supper because you're going to eat basically the leftovers from what you had during lunch for supper. All right. And the way that you would keep it warm is to put it in this warming box on top of your stove that had these little holes in it that would vent out the heat and just keep enough heat in there to keep that food warm for a few hours.
Interesting.
So we are thinking about food safety, not the same way that we think about it today, but there are lots of ways that they manage to keep the food nice and fresh.
Yeah, it's just interesting to me that just through culture that people understand that certain things need to be kept cool, certain things need to be kept warm, even if they may not even know what a germ is.
Sure, of course. We did have germ theory by this time, but you're right. I mean, throughout time, and, you know, it's a pretty good hint when someone drops dead, and you're like, maybe we should change something.
Maybe that milk smell was a clue.
I just wonder how long it took them to figure it out. Okay, so at lunch, you would have had a big, delicious meal. We'll call it dinner. You'd have a meat. Now, this meat might be chicken, pork, beef. You probably would have raised the animal that you're going to be eating, although we did have butchers and people went to butchers. All of this is to say that people are tending to eat the foods that they grow and create at home, but that doesn't mean that that's the only options they had, and people would have mixed it up just like we do today, especially if they're richer, right? Yeah. The richer you are, the more likely you are to go and buy things that you don't need or that you could create yourself. Okay, so the typical lunch has a meat, chicken, beef, pork, and then vegetables from the garden, and they could either be fresh or canned because you would have a whole variety of canned vegetables waiting for you, especially for during the colder months. So according to the paper, a typical dinner might consist of ham, sweet potato, turnip greens, Irish potatoes, and fresh tomatoes with green onions. The mother added cornbread or a light bread to make a balanced and delicious noon meal. She always made a dessert, such as peach pie or strawberry cobbler. Now, I can remember from my youth going to my grandparents' house and them eating like this. And every single time you had that dessert, right? And I just feel like I'm perpetually disappointed by the lack of desserts in my life these days after living like that. And then, of course, those leftovers would be put over the stove in that warming space. And so this is all going to be very nutritious, garden food cooked up deliciously. The process of getting to that point is going to be really difficult, right? So we talked about all these hours that the woman is doing in housework, but that doesn't even necessarily include things like gardening and things like that. Typically in Texarkana, if you are a white household, you would probably have someone that you hire to help you, and it would probably be a black person. And you would pay them very little money, maybe $1 a week, or some people even only paid them in meat and vegetables. Sometimes they would have a woman helping as a maid and sort of around the house, but sometimes they would actually have a couple, and you'd have sort of the husband or brother or whatever. You'd have them working sort of in the outdoor stuff, helping the dad or helping outside. And then you'd have the woman helping in the kitchen, doing things like cooking, canning, cleaning, laundry, which is a massive process that takes, tons of time. So we need to understand that this isn't just, in many cases, it isn't just the sort of woman of the household doing all of this on her own. She not only has hired help in general, but she might also bring her children into it. I'd also like to say that these women, these domestic servants who were helping these white women in their homes, they would have also still had 58 hours of housework a week to do at their own homes.
Right.
So this is, just insane to think about. While they're sort of taking a part of the burden off of the woman that has hired them, it adds to their own burden of what they have to do throughout the week. And of course, takes time away from their own family and their own home. So I thought that was important to note, because we like to think that, everyone's self-sufficient, but at this time, they're really not, especially in Texarkana, it would have been very, very common. And in fact, the largest employment section for Black women at the time would have been in domestic service. And that's going to continue all the way up until like the 1980s, I believe. So let's not get confused about, how independent the people are doing everything. After you cook your food, you would have started doing the dishes, and it's going to take a really long time, and it's going to be an involved process. And one of the things that you're going to have to do, in addition to getting your water boiling if you don't have a wood stove, would be to use soap. And how are we getting the soap? Well, we're making it ourselves as well. You would have actually boiled up your pig skin until it rendered out the fat, and then you would have eaten the pigskin that's left over as cracklings.
Right.
And then the fat that's left in the pan, that's what you're going to use to turn into lye soap.
Adding lye.
No, I don't. What is lye? It's like a wood ash, right?
Yeah.
So you're going to make the soap, and then that's what you're going to be using to wash your dishes. Mm-hmm. So as you can see, every sort of aspect of daily life is involved in sort of this manufacturing of your own home goods in some way.
Now, see every part of the buffalo.
Right, exactly. she might have used this time also to make her bread, as we talked about. Now, you could order it from the grocery store, but most people are going to make it at home during this period. And some are even going to grow their own grain, which is a little crazy to think about, right? Not even buying the flour, but making it yourself.
And there probably would have been dedicated bakeries too, right?
Well, here we would have typically had there would have been bakeries, but we don't have the big public sort of ovens and things like that around here that some places do. But we would have had bakeries for sure. The bread, if you're making it from your own grain, you're even going to take that grain that you're growing and have it take it to a grist mill where it's going to be ground here in Texarkana. And they say that the grain that comes out of this, the flour that comes out of it, it's a light brown flour. And it is a lot more nutritious than the sort of bleached and processed food that we have today. And you would be baking bread at least once a week. And that's in addition to all of your cornbreads and biscuits, pies, cobblers, all of that different stuff that you have around the house as far as baked goods, okay? And of course, as I mentioned, that bread would probably go with your child or your husband off to work with him when you're packing that lunch. Although we do have several people in the paper, she makes a point to say they always have bread around, but they didn't want it. They wanted those biscuits and cornbread, which I think we can all kind of identify.
Right.
Now, as far as grocery store goes, you know, grocery stores go, I think we could tackle sort of the public aspect of this a little bit more next time, but I do want to say that women would have been going to the grocery store and buying things that they needed. First of all, we would have bought things that we can't grow here, that we can't make here. One particularly popular thing to buy was almonds because we don't have the climate for that here. And almonds and almond milk have always been very, very popular and useful in the kitchen. And so that might have been something that people would have purchased.
Interesting.
We also have a record of of cane syrup, which was made locally in Cass County, being sold by the gallon out of grocery stores here for just a few cents.
Wow.
And so that would have been from cane that was grown here and processed. So at the store, you would have had a variety of things from other places, mm-hmm. right, like the almonds, but also things that are local fare that they would have been selling to people.
What's the difference between that cane sugar and molasses?
I think that the amount of processing that goes on. I think that as you boil the sugar or the sugar syrup, it becomes purer and purer, and then it becomes lighter and lighter in color.
Okay.
So this would have been kind of like Steen's cane syrup, if you've ever had that, or if, I don't know, that's maybe an Alabama thing, but it's kind of like a syrup that you might have poured on stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And they're going to also have, so they're going to have the grocery store, and the woman might have gone to the grocery store by herself. She might have gone with someone else. Women probably would have had a little surrey of their own, a little like kind of wagon type of thing, a small little wagon type of thing. And they would have been able to hitch up that horse and go to town with their surrey by themselves. And they would have done that, and it would have been a normal thing to do. But you might also have gone to the grocery store on the weekend with your family all together. The grocery stores would have been sort of around Broad Street area. Mm-hmm. And so you would have taken your horse. Now, the roads that you're going on aren't very good. They are not paved at this time. And in fact, Broad Street has a boardwalk on it. Do you know what a boardwalk is?
On either side, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, like a broad wooden sidewalk.
Yeah, it's a wooden sidewalk before they had like paving and things mm-hmm. like that. And we have accounts of women who are going to the grocery store in their long dresses getting caught on nails that are sticking out of the boards on the Broadway or sort of the boardwalk on Broad Street.
A little bit of an improvement over the mud, though.
No, for real, right? You would have been grateful for it. And so you would have gone to the grocery store. You might have also stopped for a soda at, we had a soda fountain here at a drugstore. Mm. It had some lush, plush velvet chairs that you could sink into while you had your nice soda. You might have a little sip of that.
It's so hard to remember that at one time, carbonated water was this fantastic gimmick that everybody just couldn't get enough of.
Oh, I still think it's magic.
Yeah.
You might have seen grocery delivery going through the streets. Grocery delivery would have been common. We're kind of back to that moment in time now. But it wouldn't have been unusual for people to do that then. You might have seen telegram boys running around or riding on their bicycles. And it would have been an event for the family. You might have had a big Saturday out of it, you know.
Yeah.
And so shopping was something that women could do whenever they needed to, but it could also be a family event and something that everyone did together and a chance to come into town and experience the big city of Texarkana, right? And it was a relatively big city at this time, and it was growing really fast. But like I say, most of the stuff that people are going to have, they're going to bring from the house. And they are going to preserve a lot of foods so that they have things all year round. They're thinking ahead in a way that we don't really have to think of today. Mm-hmm. Gems, jellies, preserves are going to be made out of strawberries they're growing, blackberries, plums, peaches, grapes, and of course, grapes, including like the local versions, which are muscadines and scapinungs. Mayhaw, we even have pawpaws around here, apples, apple trees. We have lots of nut trees, you know, like pecan, particularly successful around here. You would dry the fruits that you're growing, you would preserve them, you would jam them, you would jelly them, but you'd also dry them. You would make dried apple slices. You would make your own grapes out of your, your own raisins out of your grapes.
Yeah.
Which is kind of crazy to think about. Yes, we would have wine and distilled food. You might make a minced meat pie from some of these preserved fruits that you have dried later. You're also canning vegetables, tomato, squash, okra, corn, peas, butter beans. Now, I think we all still eat that stuff, right? Like I used to get made fun of when I lived in the North because I would say that four vegetables and a piece of bread is a dinner. And they'd be like, that's not a meal. I'd be like, you don't understand. This is a vegetable dinner. And this is sort of the attitude that we still have a lot of times around here.
Yeah.
And it would have been common then. They're going to jar these things. They're going to have these glass jars that they're going to reuse every year. You put your vegetables in there after you clean them and cut them. You cover them up with water. You add your seasoning if you're gonna. And then you put these lids on it that have this sort of wax ring around them and you boil them. And what that's gonna do is it's gonna seal the jar.
Right.
You'd use the same jars every year, but you'd have to rebuy those lids. So you'd be going to the grocery store for those. But everything else is very low cost. You're also going to keep things, especially turnips, in cellars or in, we don't have a lot of basements here, so sometimes even just in a dugout. Now, turnips, we don't really think about too much. There are two really important things that they would have been eating from the turnips, not just the turnip itself, but what else?
The greens.
The turnip greens. So why do we love greens here so much? Well, this is a food that's easy to preserve. What they would do is they dig a hole, they put in some sawdust, cover it up with dirt, and those turnips could stay all year. And you could have turnips and turnip greens for your meals even throughout the winter. And so I think that it's interesting when we look at foodways, we can kind of understand why are we eating the things that we eat?
Right.
Why do we love pecan pie so much? Well, you had a pecan tree outside, right?
Because it's all we had once upon a time. Yeah.
Also, it's the best, but that's just a coincidence, right?
Right.
And so this is going to be sort of how we're going to treat our vegetables. We're thinking ahead. And we're preserving for the future. You're also doing this, as I mentioned, with the animals that you're slaughtering and using your smokehouse for. Now, they would use all the parts of the pig that they could, including, you know, the skin, the bladder. They would use all sorts of different things. And as I mentioned, it was a really popular dish to have hogshead cheese at the time. Now, I know some of you know what it is, but I'll describe it as the 1910 Texarkana cookbook described it for you. All right. Having thoroughly cleaned a hog's or pig's head, split it in two. Take out the eyes and the brains, obviously. Clean the ears. Throw scalding water over the head and ears. Then scrape them well. Then take out every particle of bone. Chop the meat fine. Season to taste with salt and pepper and maybe a little pounded sage. And store in a crock. And that would have been your lunch meat for a very, very long time. Now, to us, that doesn't sound very appetizing the way it's described, but I guarantee that's the stuff that we're having in our hot dogs and bologna.
So. Here's a little trivia. The working title of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre was Head Cheese.
Oh, my gosh. That is so funny. So there we go. A long history of gross sounding, but apparently delicious food. Now,
yeah, I've never tried it, but you know, it's there's just sort of a whole category of that kind of food, like Snapple and the Northeast, where it's just sort of the leftover.
Scrapple, you said.
Scrapple, yeah.
Snapple's going to see you.
Snapple's a whole different thing. Scrapple, yeah.
Yeah, I've never had it, but I'm like appalled by it just because of what it sounds like, even though I eat our own stuff that's the same.
Right.
You know, it's like not.
I'll eat a fried Spam sandwich.
Yeah. They would have had fewer compunctions, I think, about what they're eating as far as like being squeamish about certain things.
Yeah, then. They must have been a lot more accustomed to just the nitty gritty of animal parts.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're watching the processing of it. They're watching the butchering of it. But also, you just don't have as much room to be picky because you don't have options, you know? If you don't eat what they cook for you, then you ain't eating sometimes. That's how my grandparents were, you know?
Yeah.
So now that we've gone through the day, let's talk a little bit about supper. Now, supper is a lighter meal at this time, what non-locals might call dinner, which of course is supper. So what were they eating at supper? They're going to eat those leftovers from the day. They would have had the meat and the vegetables and the bread and maybe the cobbler that they had, whatever's left over that's been warming in the warming box. The mama might make something additional for it too, like a soup, something light, so they have it with the leftovers. And then she might make an additional cornbread or biscuits to go with that. Sometimes supper was something as simple as cornbread with milk. Mm-hmm. My granddad ate that all the time for supper.
Grandma ate that all the time.
All the time. Yeah. And
buttermilk.
Buttermilk. Yes, exactly. You could also with peas. My papa would do like black-eyed peas with cornbread. If you think about what those elders were eating when we were young or before your time, if you're a young person listening to this, there's a reason for that. It's because this is how everyone was eating at the time. You had this big meal at lunch. It fueled you through your day. It gave you the energy that you needed to do hard work in a lot of cases. And then by the time you get home to supper, it's a light meal. And it might be something very, very simple like that. So we're not really making a big fuss out of supper. It's the lunch that's the big meal.
Yeah, I wonder when that shifted to where now we normally consider supper to be the biggest meal of the day.
You know, I reckon it might have something to do with the fact that we are all at school and work now.
Yeah.
You know, and so we still want to have that sort of together meal. Mm-hmm. And that's the one. But certainly during this time, we still haven't made that shift. We're still lunch people, which I think is interesting. We don't think of ourselves as lunch people, right? But this area traditionally, typically, has been. And of course, you might have had an extra dessert. They made a lot of delicious desserts around here. We have examples of a nut cake, chocolate cake, lemon cake, angel cake. Now, this angel cake took 20 egg whites.
Wow.
I mean, that's a lot of egg whites, right? They are not skimping. And in fact, we have a recipe for jam cake, and it includes a cup of butter, a cup of cream, 1.5 cups of jam, and 6 eggs. Now, this is not Atkins diet. We are not doing the Mediterranean diet here. They are eating for real, right?
Yeah, I don't know how real this is, but people say pound cake is because it's a pound of flour, a pound of sugar, a pound of butter.
That is actually a fact. Yeah, that is correct, yes. So basically, you know, they're worried about fueling themselves for their day. They're worried about having adequate nutrition, having full children. They're not worried about, I'm not saying they're not worried about the figures, but the typical sort of focus of the meals would have been good nutrition and filling people up, not necessarily the macros that we get obsessed with today, right? So this would have been sort of what the typical day would go like. And then, of course, whenever you wake up again, you have to start it all over. So the mom would have been the last one probably in bed. A lot of times it would have been her job to attend to cleaning up after supper and preparing everything she needed to prepare for the next day. And then she would have gone to bed and woken up again and done it again.
Yeah. I'm wondering about the kids. I'm sure that was all gendered too, like with the girls helping out in the house and the boys.
There is some gender to it. That's a great question. There is some gender to it, but we also see that kids in general are just roped into almost everything they can get roped into. Like we have all these accounts. Like, in fact, some of the kids in the story in the paper were complaining like their mama wouldn't let them milk the cow because they'd be like, you're doing it wrong. You don't know how to do it. But other kids, that was their daily job that they had to do. Yeah. They had to go out and do that. Taking care of the animals was a very common job that was given to kids. We also know that kids were taken out of school. Schools were shut down around here during harvest time because the kids would have all been expected to go out in the harvest, perhaps during planting season as well. But it depends on what the family needed. But they would have certainly all been out there harvesting. They would have been, one typical job for a kid would have been churning the milk. So that is a job that I would never want to do. It'd give you great arms.
Right.
But it is a lot of work. And so you would have been like, little Jamie, get out there and churn that butter, you know, and the kids would have been helping out. And like I said, the kids are also doing things like a lot of fishing. They're not only fishing for fish, they're fishing for crawdads and things like that, not only for fun, but for food. And hunting is another pastime, especially for boys, that's going to contribute to the food for the family. They might be set out together berries or nuts or things like that. So it's really up to the mom, the woman who's running the household, how much those kids are going to be involved, and maybe a little bit down to how controlling she is over whether how well things get done.
Yeah, right. Let's talk a little bit about special occasions, like a holiday or a birthday. What might be different on a special day?
That's a great question. You might have slaughtered an animal for that special day, right? Mm-hmm. You might be raising an animal and it would die on that special occasion, which sounds kind of
Christmas goose.
Yeah, so it sounds kind of unfestive for us, but that's actually what happens with the animals we eat still today. We just don't see it, right?
Yeah.
You would have saved up special foods for that. You might have bought things like nuts and fancy preserved foods, fruits at your grocery store for things like that. Mm-hmm. Sugar, you would have been buying sugar. Most people around here, even though we can grow sugar cane, most people are not making their own sugar cane because it's just cheaper for most people to buy it. You would have had more treats and sweets, and you would have had your whole family around you, and they would have been bringing food too. We're not so atomized in this moment. There are a lot of people who are living in extended family circumstances, and they would have had a lot of hands on deck for a special occasion like that. We might have also gone out to eat, which is something we can explore more in another one, where, you know, there were times when you might have gone down to Texarkana and eaten at a fancy restaurant, because we did have those. We did have places to go out to eat. We had little diners and things like that that people would enjoy, but it would have been much more of a special occasion. But
I've heard many stories about how special it was to get an orange for Christmas.
I was just thinking about that, right? Another thing they might have done, you know, kind of similar to like the dried meats and nuts and things, dried fruit meats and nuts, I should say, is during the holidays, they might have had exotic foods that they might not have been willing to pay for, you know, at all times. You know, chocolate bars, orange is a very famous example. Why is an orange so special? Well, we don't grow them here, right? And so for the holidays, it would have been a time to come together with food and family. But we have to remember that a lot of people in this area were not that rich. So there wouldn't have been a huge change other than probably the volume of food that they're serving.
Yeah.
And the number of people that they're serving during those holidays. They probably would prepare for a long time in advance for them as well, making sure that they had enough food laid up and preserved and saved for the special occasions. And we know that 4th of July was very popular to have a big picnic. They had big Easter celebrations, maybe at a church or a potluck, but maybe at home. And of course, Christmas and Thanksgiving, the traditional ones that we have today. They would have been picnicking a lot more than we do. They would have been having little get-togethers in the outdoors. They had a lot of church functions. And we read, it's no coincidence that a lot of these recipes we're talking about come from church cookbooks.
Yeah.
Because that would have been not only a center of the community, but a center of celebration of special days like this.
Was it Memorial Day that used to be called Decoration Day? Is that right?
I don't know.
I think that's right. And what they used to do is go have picnics in the graveyard.
Yeah, graveyards were the early parks. I mean, it was only green spaces a lot of places had. But there would be problems with, like, it would rain really hard and a hand would start poking up. And you'd be like, oh, I'm off my egg salad.
Now you're thinking about Halloween. That's a different holiday. All right. Well, that's super interesting. Thanks so much. Where are we going to go eat now?
Oh, hungry. We need to go get a vegetable dinner.
Mother Kelly's.
Yes, yes. The best. I mean, I was reading about this stuff and I was like, dang, we still eat this way. And I'm so glad.
I love my black eyed peas on New Year's Day.
Butter beans. I'm going to eat some cornbread and milk.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Carl.
On the Line is a Texarkana Gazette podcast recorded in Star Bear Studio, right here in downtown Texarkana, USA. Follow On the Line on our website, texarkanagazette.com/podcast. To support the show, post a positive review wherever you get your podcasts. And please, spread the word by sharing a link or telling a friend. I write, produce, and edit the show, and I'd love to hear from you. Email me at krichter@texarkanagazette.com and let me know what you think. I'll see you next time on the line.